It's a rainy day in New York, and welcome to another edition of Uptown Radio. I'm your host, Maureen Saint.
And I'm Christina Makaya. Have you been feeling stressed recently? Your clergy person might be able to help. A new mental health intervention is being trialed in Places of Worship and other community-based organizations across the city.
You become anxious. When you get nervous, the first thing we do is we tense up and we stop breathing.
Home care workers in New York City are sometimes asked to work 24-hour shifts, yet they are paid for only 13. And workers say they're not getting the rest they're legally allowed.
We want to abolish this inhumane 24-hour workday and stop the violence against women of color.
And the solar eclipse is coming in just 10 days. We hear some longstanding traditions, like this one from the Cherokee.
When that animal goes and tries to eat the sun, it indicates to them to go out and make noise.
And some personal perspectives from our reporters. All that and more after the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Authorities have yet to formally identify the four missing people who are presumed dead after a cargo ship crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland 2 days ago. But we are starting to learn more about the names of some of them through victims' relatives. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran tells us more about one of them.
Minor Suazo Sandoval came to the U.S. from Honduras nearly 20 years ago. His brother, Martin Suazo, describes him as generous.
Ayudando a los demás, eso era como él se sentía feliz.
He says helping others made his brother happy. Minor Suazo had been working for the last 2 years for the crew that maintains Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. He was there early Tuesday morning repairing potholes when the bridge collapsed. Suazo's brother said the 38-year-old will be dearly missed in his hometown, where he helped finance the building of a hotel that brought jobs to rural Azacualpa, Honduras. He also paid for people's medicines and doctor's appointments in the town. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
Rebuilding the bridge is expected to take years. Engineer Matisse Levy, author of the book Why Buildings Fall Down, How Structures Fail, spoke to us about what he would propose if he were part of the team exploring the redesign.
The bridge is what you call fracture critical, which means that one span fails and then the whole thing comes down. I might advocate for a bridge that is built differently so that if one span fails, the other two spans would act independently.
Former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton are scheduled to appear with President Biden tonight in New York City. NPR's Elena Moore reports they'll attend a Biden re-election campaign fundraiser.
It's a sold-out show at Radio City Music Hall, and more than 5,000 supporters are expected to attend. According to the Biden campaign, the fundraiser will bring in over $25 million, which they say is, quote, the most successful political fundraiser in American history. The event comes as Biden continues to be neck and neck with former President Donald Trump in recent national polls. That said, Trump continues to trail Biden in fundraising. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump resumed today, with Trump's team arguing the indictment should be thrown out. Lawyer Steve Sadow says claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election constitute political speech protected under the First Amendment. A prosecutor argued Trump's statements were not protected because they are central to criminal activity alleged in the Fulton County DA's racketeering case against the Republican and co-defendants. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 47 points before the close at 39,807. The S&P was up 5. From Washington, this is NPR.
Earlier today, the man accused of fatally shooting an NYPD officer in Queens on Monday was charged with first-degree murder. Officer Jonathan Biller was shot by Guy Rivera from Queens when the policeman approached his illegally parked car. This is not Rivera's first interaction with the justice system. His record includes 21 prior arrests for charges including assault, robbery, and possession of a controlled substance. To commemorate Officer Diller, Governor Hochul has directed flags on all state buildings to be flown at half staff. Diller's wake took place this afternoon on Long Island, and hundreds attended, including Donald Trump. Three presidents will be in town this evening when the Democratic Party holds a fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall for President Biden. The NYPD says to expect street closures with 49, 50s, and 51st streets shut down to traffic. pedestrian traffic is also limited as of 3 p.m. in the same places. We'll have more on the President's fundraising later on today's show. Right before the kickoff of the 2024 Auto Show at the Javis Center tomorrow, Governor Hochul has announced over 100 new chargers for electric vehicles will be built in New York City. This is part of the city's $1 billion investment aimed at making transportation electric and reducing emissions. The initiative is born from a partnership between the New York City Department of Transportation and the New York Power Authority. The great majority of charging stations will be located at 30 new Evolve New York hubs. Others will be at LaGuardia Airport. They are scheduled to be completed and ready to be used between 2025 and 2026. And baseball fans, time to step up the plate. Today is opening day for Major League Baseball. First pitch for the Yankees is scheduled for just a few minutes from now in Houston. The Mets will host the Brewers tomorrow afternoon in Queens. The Mets game was originally planned for today, but it got postponed due to weather. And speaking of weather, it's cloudy with a chance of rain in New York City. Temperatures are around 40 degrees. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Julia Leo.
Maureen, remember during the pandemic when everyone needed access to the internet to do pretty much everything?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, for some families, the struggle to pay for internet access was real. According to the Pew Research Center, 80% of U.S. households subscribe to a broadband internet service. Congress stepped in to help with something called the Affordable Connectivity Program. Families that qualified received $30 a month to subsidize access.
But that subsidy is coming to an end on Monday, and as Fahima Dejia reports, some New Yorkers are scrambling to adjust.
Tariq Baraskar is a Port Authority officer who lives with his parents and younger brother in Long Island. During the pandemic, he signed the family up for the government's Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP. Baraskar says one of the most important things they use the internet for is to talk to their family back home in India.
If, you know, we didn't have internet, we would have almost no contact with them.
But another big user of the internet in the Baraskar's house is his 25-year-old brother, who's a recent college graduate. He needed the internet for school. With Congress cutting funding for ACP, Baraskar says affording broadband is going to take some juggling.
When it comes to like living like paycheck to paycheck almost, every dollar counts.
Ryan Skowalski works for Benefits Data Trust, a national nonprofit that helps connect people to government benefits, like the ACP.
The internet really has moved from being a luxury to a necessity in the past several years, and therefore we have a significant digital divide in this country.
Which can be hard to think about in a city as wired as New York. But now the ACP is ending. Skowalski says critical services are at risk.
Public Wi-Fi just is not great when you need privacy for your job, for telemedicine appointments, a reliable connection for jobs, internships, online classes. There's just no comparison. Having that home broadband internet connection is so essential.
Especially for students.
You know, I can't imagine a worse time for ACP to expire than April, May, which is typically when final exams are, right?
Judith Aferi, who's just about to graduate from a master's program in mental health counseling, says paying for internet access is just too much for her budget.
At the moment, I'm getting about, let's just say, like $15 an hour, and paying $75 for internet services, which I need for my school project and assignments, is way too much.
Not only is the internet expensive, but the costs have been increasing. So much so that Jordan Borges has gone 3 months without paying his bill.
In total, I got to pay around like $315.
So you're telling me it's so expensive that you're behind on your internet payments?
Yes.
As the ACP subsidy ends, Tariq Baraskar, the Port Authority officer, is getting lots of emails from internet service providers trying to sell him on plans.
We're definitely going to look into other options. We're going to see if there's any other programs that offer a cheaper internet or like discounts on internet.
For Baraskar, it's just essential.
If we're unable to find anything, then it is what it is. You will have to take the L on that because internet should be a right, because you can't really do anything without access to internet.
Baraskar has a lot of research to do. Research he'll probably do online before the Monday deadline. Fahima Dagia, Columbia Radio News.
The New York Civil Liberties Union came to a landmark settlement on Tuesday. They found that Jefferson County Jail was not providing necessary medical care for incarcerated people with opioid addiction. And this treatment is supposed to be guaranteed under both federal as well as New York state laws. I spoke with the NYCLU attorney, Terry Ding, who explained more.
Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, opioid use disorder is categorized as a disability. So, jails and prisons are required to make accountable with that disability, which includes, the treatment that they need. We've been working on this issue, the availability of MOUD for incarcerated people, for years now. So MOUD stands for Medication for Opioid Use Disorder, and the kind of MOUD that we're specifically focused on here activate opioid receptors in the brain that relieve a person's craving for opioids and relieve their withdrawal symptoms. The stigma against people with OUD is a big reason why, a lot of facilities were not providing this kind of treatment. And in October of 2022, a little bit after we filed our case, New York State actually passed a new law that requires MOUD treatment to be made available for people who need it in all jails and prisons across the state.
So you say that because of this law that was passed in 2022, all prisons across New York should have this treatment available.
This case, specifically, we filed in March of 2022. And leading up to that time, we had tried to work collaboratively with Jefferson County to make this treatment available. And the county essentially didn't grant those requests for treatment.
So why is this case so important?
It was just necessary because there were so many people passing through the jail who had opioid addiction and who needed this treatment, and because they weren't getting it, were going through a profoundly painful withdrawal, dealing with relentless opioid cravings, and just at risk of relapse and overdose without the treatment.
And how are you going to be able to keep a track on making sure that incarcerated people who need this medical care are receiving this treatment?
One big area of concern is that there were significant racial disparities in who was being allowed to start treatment or get treatment and who wasn't. So the rates at which people who are incarcerated people who are Black who need this treatment is much lower than for white folks. So I think that's reflective of the overall reality that compliance has been inconsistent in different jurisdictions. But we're hopeful that in the wake of this lawsuit and in the wake of this new state law, that availability to this life-saving treatment will be much stronger across the state.
So do these prisons have this treatment available, or is it an issue of cost of getting this treatment in?
I think the cost issue is something that these correctional facilities have talked about before as an obstacle. In the long run, making this treatment available is not just life-saving, it's cost-saving, because it reduces the rate of the use of contraband opioids in jails and prisons. It helps people stay on treatment at much higher rates, which makes it easier both for them to adjust back to life in the community once they're released, makes them much less likely to relapse and overdose. And so we think it's really sort of a no-brainer that this kind of treatment should be made widely available for people who need them.
Terry, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Home care workers in New York City are sometimes asked to work 24-hour shifts, yet they're only paid for $13. Why?
Well, the law assumes they get breaks, 3 hours for meals and 8 hours for sleep, including 5 hours of uninterrupted rest. But workers say they're not getting the rest they're legally allowed.
A bill has been introduced to abolish 24-hour shifts, but it's stalled. And, as Tommaso Baronia reports, workers continue to push for change.
It's a Wednesday morning, and a hungry crowd is circling in front of City Hall. They're carrying colorful signs, wearing red bandanas, and chanting,
"No more 24! I'm here with
Sultana Hussein.
What are we protesting for today?
So home care attendants are forced by their agencies to work 24-hour shifts.
Hussein is one of the protesters, and she has personal reasons for being here today.
My mom is a home health aide, so this is an intimate issue for me as well.
There are almost 1.5 million seniors in New York City, and the city's elderly population is growing dramatically. As a result, the number of home aides responsible for their care has more than doubled. As of 2022, there were over 500,000 of home health aides statewide.
We have tried to get a bill passed with City Council called No More 24. It has not been successfully passed. We have been protesting at City Hall for several months now to no avail.
City Council member Christopher Marte sponsored the bill. It will limit the shift to 12 hours within a 24-hour period. Marte introduced the bill twice, in 2022 and then again earlier this month, and it got stuck twice. So today, some protesters are here trying a dramatic solution, a hunger strike. Home care workers stepped onto a small wooden stage to share their stories and the impact of the job on their health. Gui Hua Song, a retired Chinese-American home care worker, says the job was a nightmare for her. Her words were translated by an interpreter.
I am one of 24-hour shifts for 8 years. I got badly injured working 24 and can no longer work.
Song wants to put an end to the long shifts, and she supports the new bill. Like Song, the majority of workers present are women and live in Chinatown.
Today, we are here again to demand that City Council Speaker Adams immediately brings Intro 615 to a vote. We want to abolish this inhumane 24-hour workday and stop the violence against women of color.
The hunger strike went on for 5 days, but at the end, the council had still not voted on the bill. The protest was led by an advocacy group that supports home health aid workers' rights. Jun Chan volunteers with the group. He grew up in Chinatown. He says he knows a lot of workers like Song.
It's just one of those things. It's like, oh, if you're Chinese and you grew up in Chinatown, you're going to have either, your mom's doing home care, or not necessarily 24 hours, but, you know, like that job, you know, you have a relative or a friend's mom. In my case, my friend's mom was doing 24 hours.
Chuan says last year, the advocacy group held a rally every month in front of City Hall. But the bill remains stuck, and the group blames Speaker Adrian Adams for never allowing a vote to move forward.
And so, you know, we expect, oh, she's doing this on behalf of the home care agencies and the insurance companies.
Christopher Marte, the bill sponsor, agrees. He also blames special interests.
We know that there are home care agencies that don't want to pay the workers more. There's also insurance companies that are making money off Medicare based off the current system, right? You got to think about it. If someone's working for 24-hour shifts and only getting 13 hours of pay, who's getting the other 11?
When asked their thoughts on the bill and whether the current law treats workers fairly, three of the largest healthcare agencies in New York declined to comment. For now, there's no vote plan for the bill. Tommaso Baragno, Columbia Radio News.
March Madness is in full swing, and the first round of men's and women's NCAA Sweet 16 teams face off tonight.
For people who bet on sports, this is game time. The American Gaming Association estimates nearly $3 billion will be bet on March Madness this year alone. Apps like FanDuel and DraftKings are making it easier than ever for people to place bets virtually every second of a game. And on college athletes.
Desiree Nick-Farjam reports on the problems sports betting is creating for gamblers and athletes alike.
First, let's talk about the pressures online sports betting puts on college athletes. San Diego State's men's team is in the first of the Sweet 16 matchups, and at a press conference yesterday, Coach Brian Dutcher said his players are facing a lot of pressure, often directed to them as individuals.
People complaining about how they're playing,
missing shots and they just get beat up constantly.
Dutcher says one of the challenges is proposition bets, or prop bets for short. These allow people to bet on players' individual stats rather than the outcome of a game.
Just because they're kids with big bodies doesn't mean they're not affected by social media, by pressures outside of the small world they live in. And so whether that's prop bets that people are texting them and posting stuff, yeah, it's unfortunate.
But for some, unfortunate doesn't cut it. Yesterday, the head of the NCAA's Charlie Baker released a statement that the league is taking steps to block prop betting. But with roughly two-thirds of Americans living in states where people can place minute-to-minute bets, the league is going to need some help from the government.
We are dealing with a massive and growing public health crisis involving a known addictive product. Let me repeat that. A known addictive product.
That's Congressman Paul Tonko. He represents New York's 20th district, which includes Albany. He sponsored a bill in Congress to address gambling addiction. So here we are at the second group that's harmed by online sports betting, the people placing the bets. Tonko says one out of five people with a gambling issue will attempt suicide, making it one of the most dangerous mental health challenges.
Our new legislation, it takes a comprehensive public health-oriented approach of requiring states that offer sports betting to meet minimum federal standards.
One of those standards is the app's use of artificial intelligence behind the scenes to curate bets for their users based on their betting activity. The app then pings them to keep them betting. Harry Levant is from the Public Health Advocacy Institute.
And sadly, this extraordinary technology and information advantage is used to make the products more addictive and create instant individualized offers and incentives to gamble.
One of the challenges in regulating sports betting is that the laws vary state by state. Sean Fluharty is a state representative in West Virginia and president of the National Council of Legislators from Gaming States. A law passed last night that allows the state to ban bettors who threaten and harass athletes online.
You don't have a right to bet on sports. It's absolutely just a privilege, and that privilege can be revoked if you're threatening players.
Fluharty says sustainable models like this one will protect consumers and athletes.
We have an obligation to make sure that we have a safe environment for our student athletes. We want entertainment to be the goal here, not gambling addictions.
Will Kaiser is standing outside of a sports bar in Morningside Heights. He's showing me his FanDuel account and the March Madness setup.
So if you look here, like for Thursday, the first three options it gives you is the spread, the money line, and then total points. So you can bet on Clemson. They have a 7.5 spread. So that means that if they lose by 7 points, you would win money. But if they lose by 8 points, you don't win money.
Kaiser says he's a pretty casual FanDuel user, but he likes the extra excitement he gets when betting on a game he's watching.
But I would recommend not to do it at all. I would say definitely don't bet any money that you would be afraid to lose.
For some, that's easier said than done. Desiree Nikvarajam, Columbia Radio News.
Now, on to climate news. According to a report from the Adams Administration, extreme heat is the biggest threat to human life in New York City as a result of climate change. That same report laid out exactly how the city's planned to tackle it, including a long-term climate goal which aims to cover 30% of the city in the cooling shade of tree canopies.
The report was released in spring 2023, so 1 year on, how much progress has been made? Dominic Hall Thomas takes us through a stroll on Central Park to find out.
And what kind of trees are we actually looking like here? Is it a bit of a mixture?
It's a mix of oaks and black cherry trees. You know, you can sort of see there's a pathway that leads you down into a forest.
This is Emily Walker. She works for the Natural Areas Conservancy.
Most of what you see is just canopy. It looks a little bit fallow at the moment because it's just starting to come back, springing into life.
The ground is carpeted with little yellow flowers. The trees have buds with emerald green tips, and a small stream flows between the tree trunks. And it's lucky that the trees here are springing into life, because the weather and the city is about to start heating up. The tree canopies provide shade, so in the summer, parks like this remain much, much cooler than the surrounding city.
I think there was a 13-degree difference.
13 degrees,
which is a lot if it's, you know, 95 degrees outside when you're, like, out on the street.
And that's why Mayor Adams made tree coverage so central to the city's plans to tackle extreme heat. The Parks Department says last year they planted over 15,000 trees. But how close does that get them to their 30% goal? Well, right now,
the canopy coverage for the five boroughs is at 22%, so we have 8% to go.
Doesn't actually sound like that much.
Doesn't sound like that much, but when you think about the context in which we have the ability to add trees or increase canopy, it's actually a pretty significant lift.
Which means at this rate, it would take nearly 3 decades to hit that target. In the meantime, built-up areas get the hottest during the summer when concrete absorbs summer heat. Problem areas like Harlem and the Bronx have very little tree coverage and a high density of buildings. And you can't just dig into the sidewalk. There's power lines, gas mains, and of course the subway to contend with. And on top of that, trees are expensive. It costs an estimated $3,500 to plant and maintain one tree, according to the Parks Department. They need regular watering for 2 years, which the budget doesn't fully cover. So, who is left to do the job? On Frederick Douglass Boulevard in Harlem, the street is lined with a few small trees, but no behemoths to provide substantial shade. So I asked residents, if the city asked you to water a young tree,
would you do it?
Hell no. That's what the rainwater's for, no? Like, I have a life. No. Not because I don't love trees, but I'm like, I'm sorry, my time is money.
No. I would not. The idea of it would be nice, but actually maintaining it would be a freaking headache.
Daniel McGrath, Christopher Williams, and Selena Johnson all say they would appreciate more trees, but not enough to take care of them without pay. I reached out to the city's climate office to ask how they plan to fund the rest of this project and how long it would take, but they didn't respond in time for air. According to last year's report, the Parks Department wants to promote the preservation of existing trees and to plant another 15,000 trees next year. Now, they just have to figure out who will water them. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Dominic Hall-Thomas.
Have you ever tried to learn a foreign language and decided Duolingo just wasn't cutting it? As part of our new series here on Uptown Radio, of Personal Perspectives, Samuel Eli Shepherd describes a time he took the concept of language immersion to a whole new level.
Growing up in Toronto, I had an insecurity that most Americans don't even consider. Je ne peux pas parler français. I can't speak French. Canada has two official languages, English and French. Every student attends French class through grade 9. To get a federal job, you must be fully bilingual. But I did not learn French. The only phrases I remember from grade school are, Est-ce que je peux aller à toilette? Can I go to the restroom? Then I moved to Montreal for undergrad, where French is the primary language spoken. When I'd try ordering from the menu at a restaurant en français, the server would roll their eyes and respond in English. My final year of studies, I started panicking. How could I prove myself to a future employer with just one language? A friend told me about a government-sponsored program called J'Explore, where English-speaking students could practice French with host families in northern Quebec for a month. It sounded perfect. So, that summer, while my classmates were embarking on expensive graduation trips across Europe, I boarded a bus, heading 2 hours north of Montreal to a college campus by Trois-Rivières, eager to learn French. Our first day, we gathered in an auditorium, and we pledged to speak French at all times. The professors explained that if we were caught speaking English more than once, we'd be sent packing. Our days were filled with classes, sports, and scavenger hunts, all in French. And Big Brother was always watching. There were rumors that some students were narcs, waiting for you to slip into English and then turn you in. But it also felt like a bit of a farce. The pandemic forced us to live with each other, not local families. So instead of being surrounded by native French speakers, we were Anglophones cosplaying as Québécois. In the shadows, when we were sure we were safe, we secretly chatted in English. I met a woman from a small town in Ontario who opened up to me about her difficult childhood. On a hike through tall pine trees one day, I became one of the first people she has ever confided in. I don't remember every lesson of passé composé, but I do remember sneaking off one evening into the city with my roommate to grab poutine at a local dive bar. He told me about his relationship troubles, and when he and my friend from the hike started dating the following fall, he credited my cleverness for bringing them together. So maybe I'm still not the perfect bilingual Canadian, but I learned to overcome my French insecurity that summer by recognizing what I am good at. I'm a person with the ability to embrace the uncomfortable, to adapt, and to forge connections in even the most unfamiliar places. And if those aren't the language skills employers are looking for, well, je ne sais quoi. Merci beaucoup for the life lessons, Quebec.
From Columbia Radio News in New York, I'm Zoe E. Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced today to 25 years in federal prison and was ordered to pay $11 billion in fines. The ex-CEO of FTX, an online cryptocurrency exchange, was convicted of stealing $3 billion from customers between 2019 and 2022. Bankman-Fried, who was 32, is currently being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn and is expected to appeal the decision. The prosecution had pushed for a 40 to 50 year sentence, while Bankman-Fried's attorney had argued for more than 6.5 years. At the hearing today, Judge Lewis Kaplan said there is a risk that Sam Bankman-Fried would do something very bad in the future, and that the 25-year sentence should keep him from doing so for a significant amount of time. The governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, has asked the Biden administration for $60 million of relief funding after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed on Tuesday. Three workers killed in the accident have been identified. A third victim, Jose Lopez, originally from Guatemala, was identified today by family members. His brother said Lopez had come to Baltimore for work. The United Nations top court has directed Israel to take steps to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza, including increasing the number of land crossings for the delivery of essential aid like food, water, and fuel. These measures come as part of a case brought by South Africa, alleging Israel's actions in Gaza amount to genocide. Israel refutes these claims, saying its military operations target Hamas and are acts of self-defense rather than targeting the Palestinian people. Britney Spears fans take note. In a series of Instagram posts, seemingly from a beach vacation, the singer says she's going through a hard time and is having trouble understanding the English language since she changed her name to Sheila Maria River Red. She posted the new name to her Instagram profile in February. Mayor Adams says subway riders may soon be passing through high-tech gun detectors to get on the train. The mayor announced the beginning of a 90-day period to gather comments and develop a plan to bring gun detection technology. Adams says the move is, quote, the next step in our ongoing efforts to keep dangerous weapons out of our transit system. It's 39 degrees and cloudy. The rain is expected to end overnight. Highs tomorrow should be in the upper 50s with partially sunny skies. Zoe E., Columbia Radio News.
Thank you, Zoe E., and we're back. You're listening to Uptown Radio. I'm Maureen Saint.
And I'm Christina Makaya.
Coming up, the city's congestion pricing saga has finally come to an end. Or has it? And a look at how one church in the Bronx is using the city's trial mental health program.
And we hear from one tribe upstate is preparing for the solar eclipse.
But first, it's no secret that rates of anxiety and depression have gone up and have remained up since the pandemic.
The demand for therapy is way higher than available appointments, and New York City is struggling to keep up. The city launched a trial mental health program, originally designed by the World Health Organization, for people facing extreme hardship, like refugees. The initiative trains community leaders in basic mental health support.
As Claire Davenport reports, some of the first people getting trained are clergy.
I'm just a few blocks away from Yankee Stadium in Lowly Nazarene Baptist Church. I'm standing between the pews and my eyes are closed.
You should take your hands and put them on your legs and close your eyes and just kind of clear your mind.
Pastor Gail Parker is guiding me through a meditation exercise.
And sometimes once you get here, I'll tell you too, just imagine wherever that place of peace for you is. It could be on a beach. It could simply be laying in your bed. But think about that place that brings you peace. To the count of four, you breathe in. One, two, three, four. Exhale. One, two, three, four.
Deep breathing is just one technique Parker learned through Problem Management Plus, PM Plus for short. She went through the training at New York's Theological Seminary. She works with Wanda Lundy, who directs the seminary's PM Plus program. Lundy was initially surprised that breathing was such a central practice.
Oh, oh, wow. Breathe. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, because when you get stressed, when you become anxious, when you get nervous, the first thing we do is we tense up and we stop breathing.
And people turned off by traditional therapy might be more open to coping strategies like deep breathing.
Because we're religious people. We don't have mental problems. A lot of people feel that way. Whatever your problem is, just take it to Jesus and you're going to be all right, you know?
Ministers go through the training and learn basic tools to help others in crisis calm themselves. And PM Plus can be used anywhere, at any time. Adam Brown is a clinical psychologist and a lead coordinator on the rollout of PM Plus in New York. Training everyday people to deliver basic mental health support has always been part of his vision.
For people in a community who might be well positioned to deliver basic forms of support because they're teachers, because they're faith-based leaders, because they're in other roles within their community.
And the research backs Brown up. A study done with Syrian refugees in Switzerland showed that those who received PM Plus reported significantly fewer symptoms of depression. And if breathing techniques or non-specialists feels a little lightweight for folks going through real adversity, Brown describes the program more like psychiatric first aid.
Care, especially mental health care, has kind of been very binary. Either you're well or you're seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And not everyone necessarily has the severity or intensity of a mental health need that warrants very high levels of specialist care.
PM Plus has trained about 100 people in New York City across 25 community organizations. And Brown is hoping this will expand to a network of hubs around the city. And back at the Lowly Nazarene Church in the Bronx, Pastor Gail Parker, who led me through the breathing exercise, says with folks she counsels, she'll use other PM Plus techniques, like homework.
Where maybe someone was kind of depressed. And I said, well, what have you stopped doing that made you happy? You got a calendar now. What I need you to do is I need you to put down once a week that you're going to do that for an hour.
Services just started. It's Palm Sunday and a busy week leading up to Easter. Pastor Parker told me she still gets nervous before sermons, but the techniques she's learned through PM Plus help her as much as they help others.
Every single time I mount the pulpit, the whole breathing thing comes back. Take a deep breath, and let's get centered so that we can worship God without all of the other stuff that you're carrying.
So the next time you have an overwhelming moment when too many Slack messages come in or when the subway is delayed again, maybe take a minute to pause and breathe. Claire Davenport, Columbia Radio News.
Gridlock alert. President Biden and former presidents Clinton and Obama are in the city today. They're here for a fundraiser tonight.
The event will also feature celebrities such as Anna Wintour and Lizzo. The president's re-election campaign says the event is expected to raise a whooping $25 million. And will be the most successful political fundraiser in American history.
Cecilia Blotto went around Radio City Music Hall to see what everyday New Yorkers would be willing to pay to support President Biden's re-election campaign. I'm standing outside Radio City Music Hall because tonight, right here, is Biden's fundraiser. The police are just starting to set up the barricades, but no crowds of eager Biden fans yet. Just a block away, Spiro, a food vendor, has just finished with the breakfast rush. How much would you spend to see Joe Biden in the flesh?
Not even $1.
No.
Not even 50 cents.
It seems like the Democrats may have to work hard at tonight's event because the cheapest tickets are going for $250. But Spiro is an ardent Trump fan.
Excited about my Trump, my boy Trump winning it easy, a landslide. The only way he loses is two ways. They kill him or they steal it like they did the last one. I pay to sit down and have dinner with Trump. When President Trump was here, everything was good. Money in my pocket, gas prices were low, supermarket was cheaper, people knew how to act.
Just a few feet away is Sammy, a security guard who's patrolling West 50th Street. He also seems unlikely to buy a ticket for tonight's event. Instead, he says he'd invest money to see Trump.
I'd give $1,000 to see him.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
He's what America's supposed to be. You know, men are men. I don't know what's going on with all this pronoun stuff. Feminizing the American men with the Democratic Party. That's what I think they're doing.
But a few blocks on Fifth Avenue, it seems like the president might have a fan in Patricia, a window shopper. She says she might pay to see the president.
My budget, probably $500.
So I imagine you're a fan?
Not really, but compared to the other party, I would take him.
Another strike for Biden. Outside of Radio City Music Hall, where Biden himself will be in just a few hours, freelance journalist Janet says she's just fed up with politics.
Would I pay for either one of them? No.
Fair enough. It seems like New Yorkers are done with elections altogether. Cecilia Blotto, Columbia Radio News.
New York City public schools are about to lose $40 million in arts funding this June. Yesterday, students and advocates held a press conference calling on the mayor and city council to find solutions, and fast.
While a lot of people have made pleas for the importance of arts education for students, this could be equally harmful for public school teachers. Kimberly Olson is the executive director of NYC Arts and Education Roundtable. She says protecting art teachers means amending state laws. Before we begin, could you tell us when arts programs started receiving federal aid? And until now, how has the funding helped?
When the COVID-19 pandemic hit back in 2020, our city put $75 million of federal stimulus money to support students. This ended up leading to partnerships with arts and cultural organizations. It supported teacher professional development to meet the needs of our students. And we were so thrilled that that funding continued. However, that funding is set to end on June 30th, which is going to impact schools across New York City.
The loss of funding clearly puts the education of students at risk. But what does this mean for certified arts teachers?
Over the past 3 years, we have experienced a loss of full-time certified arts teachers across the city. To put those numbers in perspective, in the 2019-2020 school year to the 2022-2023 school year, our city lost 425 full-time certified arts teachers. That is 14.8% of all certified arts teachers across the city. So that loss of those teachers impacts tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of students across the city in a space where that might have been the only arts teacher serving their school. We know many arts teachers were possibly teaching theater or dance pre-pandemic, but all of a sudden found themselves teaching second grade, teaching math, teaching social studies as a way to sort of meet social distancing requirements at the time. This means less arts programming for our students. It means our teachers may be getting less professional development. It means that our teachers could be potentially stretched even more thin than what they currently are.
How are teachers responding?
Unfortunately, if you look at GoFundMe and you type in arts education in New York City, you'll see way more GoFundMes than you would ever wish to see. It should not be these teachers or even students taking on the labor of making sure that they have funding to support arts education programming in their schools. And ultimately, it should not be up to the PTA of the school to make sure that a school's able to keep their arts teacher or able to make sure that the school musical happens. Because ultimately, that leads to greater inequity across our system. Arts education and access to it shouldn't be dependent on the zip code that you live in. We are working with teachers across the city to be able to get a sign-on letter that we send over to the mayor, to be able to make some noise about the importance of these programs right now and bring visibility to it. Because arts education isn't a nice to have, it is a must have.
So how does the city plan to make up for this funding gap? Can they follow any procedures from other cities that are managing this successfully?
The state of California passed a pretty exciting bill this past year, which essentially provides a guaranteed funding stream for arts and music in their schools. It will amount to tens of millions of dollars, if not more, that are going to go directly to schools so that they are able to have that foundation for arts and music across the entire state. See, another model that I can point to as well is in New Jersey. New Jersey was the first state to have 100% access to arts education for all of their students. That is huge. But one of the ways that they were able to get there is through partnership between their city school system or their state school system and their state's council on the art, in addition to transparency, so that folks understood that what gets measured gets done at the end of the day.
But how is New York state law different from states like California and New Jersey?
So these are states that have already codified arts and music a part of their core curriculum, in line with the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. I will say New York, unfortunately, is behind the times in adopting that as part of our state, and that's also been part of the roundtable's advocacy that we've been working over the past several years to codify arts and music as a part of education law. Our current law on the books is from the 1950s. A lot has changed since then. It is time that we sort of get with the times within the state and also just catch up to the rest of the country and especially up to the rest of the Northeast region.
Once again, that was Kimberly Olson, Executive Director from NYC Arts and Education Roundtable. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
The congestion pricing saga has finally come to an end. Probably. The MTA board voted to approve the plan yesterday after a four-year wait. This means starting from mid-June, drivers going below 60th Street will pay $15 a day.
Our reporter, Tommaso Baronio, went to Columbus Avenue and 60th Streets to find out how people in the area are feeling about the new pricing.
For public transportation, but that doesn't mean that much to people like John Johnson. He drives his delivery truck below 60th Street every day. He says the new plan is an aberration.
As a truck driver, for example, people that are feeding the city that are going back and forth, that are making deliveries to actually pay for going through the city. Now you want people to fork out basically, if I'm doing two trips a day, yeah, an extra $400 a month, which $400 a month, which amounts to a good, you know, like almost $6,000 a year, $6,000 a year.
Joe Blank lives on the Upper West Side. I met him at Brad's Bakery on 63rd Street. He doesn't own a car, but he does take cabs. And he doesn't trust the MTA will spend the money turns from congestion pricing the way it says it will.
And it's unfair to business people and to people who are taking cabs and everybody else, you know, who's going to have to pay for it. You know.
But there are also exceptions, like Mr. Davis, who says he doesn't think it's that big an issue, except
they need more trains. If people are going to not be driving past 60th Street, I believe that you need more train access, you need more scheduling with the buses and the trains.
Who could answer New Yorkers' concern better than Sam Schwartz, better known as Gridlock Sam, former city traffic commissioner? He says the fear that a flood of people looking for parking in the block of North 60th Street is unfounded.
A year from now, this will not be an issue except with some hardliners that will always be there. People are not going to be parking in great numbers there because there isn't much available parking. And even if you did find the parking, you then, to get to your destination, you'd have to hop on the subway or a bus. That's another nearly $6.
Do you think that New Yorkers are going to get over this?
New Yorkers would have protested if God came down and said he's building the Garden of Eden in New York City.
Congestion pricing, like it or not, starts in June. Tommaso Baronio, Columbia Radio News.
A week from Monday, on April 8th, New Yorkers will look up as the moon swallows the sun in a total solar eclipse.
They'll probably wear their funky special glasses and maybe get some popcorn. But these are markers of modern life.
And eclipses come with centuries-old traditions. Julia Leo tells one ancient eclipse story and shares some early accounts.
For centuries, part of what some of us now call New York State was inhabited by five Native American tribes at war with each other. But then, as the story goes, the creator sent a messenger to teach the tribes the laws of peace.
A man, we call him the peacemaker, joined the five different tribes together into this confederacy that we call ourselves Haudenosaunee.
Perry Ground is an indigenous storyteller and a member of the Onondaga Nation. That's one of those five tribes. The others were the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Cayuga, and the Seneca. The five tribes lived where they do now, around the shores of Onondaga Lake. Today, the city of Syracuse. Their territory included miles and miles of agricultural lands, and farming is part of their culture, still today. Ground says an eclipse was key to their unification. He tells the story as he turns to look at a brown and purple blanket hanging on the wall behind him. It has four rectangles
that represent four of the nations that joined together. They're all connected by a line running through them. And in the center is a tree.
According to the story, three of the tribes were easily convinced to make peace. But two were old doubts. The first, the Seneca, were skeptical. And to persuade them, the messenger sent by the creator told them to search the sky for a sign. And that's when it happened.
The sun disappeared. There was a total eclipse.
That was the sign the Seneca needed. And once the last tribe agreed, there was peace. Since the very first documented eclipse around 3340 BC, people have built stories to try and make sense of them. Author David Bentley Hart writes about the history of eclipses in a new anthology, Eclipse and Revelation. He says stories about eclipses were rarely as positive as the one of the Great Peace.
All the ancient and medieval and early modern accounts of eclipses I had read, they were more often than not descriptions of something terrible.
For example, when a total solar eclipse crossed Britain in 1133 BC, it was considered a bad omen. The event coincided with the death of King Harry I, and immediately afterwards, the country was thrown into chaos and civil war, and people blamed the eclipse.
Occasionally, it might be an omen of success in battle, but only because it was read as a dark harbinger of disaster for the other side.
John Steele is a professor at Brown who studies science and antiquity.
It's a fundamental response, I think, to this really rare and dramatic occurrence. And we see this also in animals. I mean, animals behave differently during eclipses.
They think it's night. Farm animals return to their barns to go to sleep and crickets start chirping. But with time, the human response to eclipses has changed. According to David Hart, the scientific revolution of the 17th century liberated us from that feeling of doom. However, among other Native American tribes, eclipses were, and still are, connected to a sense of fear. For example, the Cherokee people in northeastern Oklahoma. Ground says they interpret eclipses as a giant frog trying to eat the sun.
When that animal goes and tries to eat the sun, it indicates to them to go out and make noise, to try to scare that animal away. And back in 2017, that's exactly what they did. And when it got dark, they were making a noise and, you know, trying to scare the big frog away. And it worked because the sun came back. So
other communities across the world had similar beliefs. In China, people believed the dragon was trying to eat the sun. And in ancient Babylonia, there were accounts of people breaking pots and making noise to scare away demons that they believed responsible for the eclipse. These stories do not really surprise Perry Ground.
And to hear the similarities in the story, it really reminds me that it's a very human experience.
Ground says that despite their differences, these stories are all born from the human need to make sense of the world. So get ready to gaze up at the sky and figure out what this brief darkness means to you. Julia Leo, Columbia Radio News.
Earlier, we said that home care workers in New York City are sometimes asked to work 24-hour shifts, yet they're only paid for $13. We should have said they're paid only 13 hours.
That's it for this edition of Uptown Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Our executive producer today was Pascal Hogue. Leading our staff of reporters was senior producer Samuel Eli Shepherd. And shaping up the edition was senior editor Clara Bowders, with the help of assistant editor Desiree Nick-Fargem.
In the studio today as the director was Dean Condaleo. Dominic Hall-Thomas was in charge of Soundbite. In control of webcasting and social was Claire Davenport. And working the board was Fahima Dagia.
Zoe Yee and Julia Leo delivered our local newscasts. And day reporters Tommaso Baronio and Cecilia Blotto brought you the latest on the ground in New York. Today's commentary was also brought to you by Samuel Eli Shepherd.
Our instructors Sally Herships, Kerry Donahue, and Priscilla Alabi advised our staff. And we're your hosts. I'm Maureen Saint.
And I'm Christina Makaya. Uptown Radio is live Thursdays at 4. You can always find us at uptownradio.org. Until next time, and from all of us here in the studio, thanks for listening.